Chapter 2. The next day was a Sunday. I slept late and wakened only when the sun shone on my bed. I sprang out quickly and threw up the window. Outside it was fresh and clear. I set the spirit stove in the window seat and got out the coffee container. Frau Zalewski, my landlady, had given me permission to make my own coffee in my room. Hers was too thin, especially if one had been drinking the night before. I had already been 2 years in her boarding establishment. The locality pleased me. There was always something doing, for the Trades Hall, the Café International, and the Salvation Army barracks were all there cheek by jowl. And immediately fronting the house was an old graveyard, now in disuse. There were large trees, as in a park, arid on still nights. One could think one was in the country. On the other hand, it was usually late before there was quiet, for next to the graveyard was an amusement park with roundabouts and swing boats. To Frau Zalewski, the graveyard was a great asset. When letting a room, she would comment on the excellence of the air and the openness of the outlook, and proceed to charge a higher rent in consequence. "But, sir, think of the situation," was her invariable formula. I dressed slowly. That gave me the feeling of Sunday. I washed. I strolled about the room, read the paper, brewed the coffee. I stood at the window and saw where the street had been taken up. I listened to the birds singing in the high trees in the graveyard opposite, little silvern pipes of God. They sang to the accompaniment of the melancholy sweet drone of the barrel organs at the fair. I chose among my half-dozen shirts and socks with as much deliberation as if there had been 20 times the number. Whistling, I turned out my pockets. Small change, a pocket knife, keys, cigarettes, and there, the slip of paper with the girl's name and the telephone number. Patricia Hallman. An unusual Christian name, Patricia. I put it down on the table. Was that really only yesterday? How far off it seemed, forgotten almost in the pearl-gray fumes of alcohol. That is a remarkable thing about drinking. It brings people together so quickly, but between night and morning, it sets an interval again of years. I stuck the slip of paper under a pile of books. Should I ring? Maybe. Maybe not. These things always look different next morning. I was quite glad, as a matter of fact, to have a little peace. There had been enough trouble the last few years. Keep things at arm's length, Custer used to say. If you let anything come too near, you want to hold on to it. And there is nothing a man can hold on to. At that moment, the usual Sunday morning hate started in the room next door. I looked about for my hat that I must have put away somewhere too carefully the night before, and overheard what they were saying. It was Hasse and his wife slanging each other. For 5 years, the two had been living here in one little room. They weren't bad folk. If they had a 3-roomed flat with a kitchen for the wife and a child thrown in, their marriage would probably have gone on quite well. But a flat costs money, and a child in these insecure times, how could it be done? So there they sat on top of one another, the woman grown hysterical, and the man in constant dread of losing his little job. If that happened, he would be done for. He was already 45. No one would take him on again if he once got out of work. Such is the modern misery. Formerly, one went under slowly, and there was always a chance of still coming up again. But in these days, on the farther side of every dismissal, yawns the abyss of permanent unemployment. I tried to steal out quietly, but already there was a knock on the door and Hasse stumbled in. He dropped into a chair. He was a mild, inoffensive chap with drooping shoulders and a little mustache. A modest, conscientious clerk, but they are just the ones who fare worst today. They have probably always fared worst, Modesty and conscientiousness receive their reward only in novels. In life, they are exploited and then shoved aside. Hasse raised his hands. Think of it. 2 more dismissals at the office. I'll be next. You see if I'm not. From one payday to the next, he lived in this fear. I poured him out a schnapps. His whole body was trembling. One day he would collapse. You could see that. He had not much resistance left. And always these reproaches, he whispered. His wife had been blaming him, apparently, for the life she had to lead. She was 42, a bit spongy and faded, but of course not quite so used up as the husband. She was suffering from 11th-hour panic. It was no use mixing in. Look, Hasse, said I, you stay quietly here as long as you like. I must be going. There's cognac in the wardrobe if you prefer it. That's rum there. Here are some newspapers. Then this afternoon, take your wife out for a walk. Anywhere but out of the building. Go to the movies. It costs no more than a couple of hours at a cafe, and you have something for it afterwards. Forget is the word today, not brood. I patted him on the shoulder, but with a poor conscience.
Anyhow, the movies are always good.
Everyone can dream something there. The door of their room stood open. The woman was sobbing. I wandered down the passage. The next door was ajar. Listening. A cloud of scent issued from it. Erna Bernich, private secretary, lived there. Much too elegant for her salary, but then once a week, her boss used to dictate letters to her until morning. And next day she would be in a foul temper. To compensate, she went dancing every evening. When she couldn't dance anymore, she wouldn't want to live anymore, she explained. She had 2 friends. One loved her and brought her flowers. The other she loved and gave money. Next to her was Count Orlov, the riding master, a Russian emigre, waiter, film extra and gigolo, with gray side whiskers, a virtuoso on the guitar. Every night he prayed to Our Lady of Kazan that he might get a job as a receiving clerk in a first-class hotel, and he was prone to weep when he got drunk. Next door, Frau Bender. Nurse at a foundling hospital. 50 years of age, husband killed in the war. 2 children died of underfeeding in 1918. Keeps a tabby cat, the only one on the floor. Next, Mueller, retired accountant, editor of the magazine of some philatelist society. A walking stamp collection, nothing more. A happy man. On the last door, I knocked. Well, Georg, said I, still nothing? Georg Bloch shook his head. He was a college student in his 4th semester. To enable himself to complete the course, he had worked for 2 years in a mine. And now the money he had saved was almost gone. He had enough left to live only for 2 months. He could not take up mining again. There were too many miners out of work. He had tried every way to earn a little money. One whole week he spent delivering bills for a margarine concern, and then the concern went bankrupt. Shortly afterwards, he got a job as a paper boy and breathed again. 3 days later, he was set upon by 2 licensed vendors who took his papers from him and tore them up and warned him not to let them catch him plying a trade where he had no business. They had enough unemployed of their own. He went out again next morning as before, notwithstanding he had to pay for the papers that had been destroyed. A motorcyclist ran into him, and the papers were scattered in the mud. That cost another 2 marks. He tried a 3rd time, only to return with his coat in ribbons and his face battered. Then he gave it up. Now he just sat in his room all day in despair, studying like mad, as if it could serve any useful purpose. He ate but once a day. Yet it was of no possible consequence whether he finished the course or not. Even if he did pass, it would be at least 10 years before he could reckon on getting a post. I passed him a packet of cigarettes. Why not chuck it, Georgie? I did, you know. One can always take it up again later. He shook his head. No, unless one sticks at it, one loses the knack. I found that out mining. I couldn't do it a second time. The pale face, the protruding ears, the short-sighted eyes, the gaunt figure, the flat chest. My God. Well, good luck to you, Georgie. And next, the kitchen. A stuffed boar's head, souvenir of the late Zalewski. The telephone, semi-darkness, an odor of gas and rancid fat. The door to the passage, with several visiting cards affixed beside the bell button, my own among them. Robert Locomp. Stud, Phil. Two long rings. The card was dirty and yellow with age. Stud, Phil. That's the stuff. A long time ago, that was. I set off down the stairs to the Café International. The International was a long, dark, smoky hole with several back rooms. Near the door, by the bar, was the piano. It was sadly out of tune. Several of the wires were sprung, and the ivory was missing from some of the keys. But I was fond of it, for all that. It was a game old crock, and had shared at least 1 year of my life with me. For it was here that I had been employed as a pianist. In the back rooms, the cattlemen used to foregather from time to time, as did also the people from the amusement park. The prostitutes used to sit near the door. The barroom itself was empty, except for Alois, the flat-footed waiter behind the counter. "The usual?" he asked. I nodded. He brought me a glass of rum. I sat down at a table and stared vacantly into space. A gray band of light entered obliquely through an upper window and was reflected in the schnapps bottles on the rack. The cherry brandy glowed like ruby. Alois resumed his occupation of rinsing glasses. The cat of the proprietress was purring on top of the piano. I smoked a cigarette slowly. The atmosphere made one drowsy. What a strange voice that girl had yesterday. Husky a bit, perhaps, but sweet, too. Bring us some newspapers, Alois, said I. The door creaked. Rosa entered. Rosa, the graveyard prostitute, otherwise known as the Iron Steed, a nickname in honor of her indomitableness. She had come, as was her custom on Sunday mornings, for a cup of chocolate. Afterwards, she would be going out to Burgdorf to visit her child. Good day, Robert. Hello, Rosa. How's the youngster? Just going to find out. Here, look what I'm taking her. From a bundle of paper, she produced a doll with hectic red cheeks and proceeded to prod it in the stomach. Mama, bleated the doll. Rosa beamed. Fine, said I. You wait, though. She tilted the doll backwards. The eyes shut with a snap. Well, I never. Rosa was delighted and set about wrapping up the doll again.
You understand these things, Robert. I can see. You'll make a grandfather someday.
Think so? Said I dubiously. Rosa lived for her child. Until 3 months ago, when it started to walk, Rosa had kept it in her room. She had contrived this in spite of her profession by making use of a small closet adjoining her own room. When she came in at night with a lover, on some pretext or other, she would leave him waiting outside, while she went in and hastily pushed the pram into the closet and shut the door. Then she would return and admit her cavalier. But during the month of December, the child had to be turned out of the warm room into the unheated closet too often, with the result that it would get chilled and begin to cry at precisely those times when she was entertaining a visitor. Hard as it was, Rosa was obliged to part with her. She had placed the child in an expensive children's home, where she had given herself out for a respectable widow. Had the authorities known the truth, they would not have accepted the child. Rosa stood up.
You are coming on Friday, of course.
I nodded. She looked at me.
You know what it is for.
Of course. I had not the faintest idea, nor did I ask questions. I had made that a rule during my year here as pianist. It was much the best. By the same principle, I used to treat all the girls with the same friendliness. My position would have been impossible otherwise.
Au revoir, Robert.
Cheerio, Rosa. I stayed on a little longer. The International had become a sort of Sabbath rest to me. But today, for some reason, I was unable to arrive at the peaceful somnolence that belonged to the place on Sundays. I had another glass of rum, stroked the cat, and then left. I traipsed about the city all day. I could not make out what was wrong with me. I was fidgety and could remain nowhere for long. Late in the afternoon, I looked in at the workshop. Custer was there at work on the Cadillac. We had bought it dirt cheap at a sale a short time ago. It had been thoroughly overhauled, and Custer was just giving the final touches. It was a speculation. We hoped to make some money with it, but I was doubtful about our finding a purchaser. In bad times, people want small cars, not omnibuses like this one. I'm afraid we'll be landed with it, Otto, said I. But Custer was hopeful. It is the medium-sized car one gets left with, Bob, he explained. There is a market for cheap cars, and for quite expensive ones. There are still plenty of people with money, or who like to look as if they have it. Where is Gottfried? I asked. At some political meeting or other. The man's mad. What does he want there? Custer laughed. Doesn't know that himself, I imagine. Got a touch of spring in the blood like as not, and he must always be haring after some new thing. Maybe, said I. Anything I can do? We tinkered around until it was too dark to see. I think we'll call that a go, said Custer. We washed off the grime. Guess what I have here, he said, patting a wallet in his pocket. No idea. Tickets for the fight tonight. 2. Coming? I hesitated. He looked at me in surprise. Stilling is boxing, said he. Against Walker. Be a good fight. Take Gottfried, I suggested, feeling a fool not to be going. But I had no wish to go. I didn't know why. Got something on? No. He looked at me. I think I'll go home, said I. Letters to write and so on. One has to sometimes... Not ill, are you? He asked anxiously. Not in the least. A touch of spring in the blood, too, perhaps. All right. As you like. I strode along home. Seated once again in my room, I could think of nothing I wanted to do. I got up and roamed about. I was completely at a loss to know why I had wanted to come. Finally, I set off down the passage to visit Georg. On the way, I ran into Frau Zalewski. Gracious me, she exclaimed, taken aback. You here? That would be difficult to deny, I said rather irritably. Not out? She wagged her head of gray curls. Wonder of wonders. I did not stay long with Georg. In a quarter of an hour, I was back again. I discussed with myself whether or not to have a drink. I did not feel like it. I sat in the window and surveyed the street. Dusk flitted on bat's wings over the graveyard. The sky behind the trades hall was green as unripe apples. The street lamps were already lighted, though it was hardly dark yet, They looked as if they were freezing. I rummaged under my books for the slip of paper with the telephone number. At last. It could do no harm to ring up. After all, I did more or less promise to. Probably the girl wouldn't be at home anyway. I went into the passage where the telephone was, took up the receiver, and asked for a number. While I awaited an answer, I felt a pleasant expectancy welling up out of the black earpiece. The girl was in. Then, when the deep, slightly husky voice spoke out suddenly, like a ghost, into the smell of fat and clatter of dishes from Frau Zalewski's parlor, a soft voice speaking slowly, as if it pondered each word, all my discontent vanished. I hung up the receiver after making an appointment for the day after tomorrow. Life suddenly seemed no longer pointless. Crazy, thought I, and shook my head. Then I took up the receiver once more and spoke to Custer. Have you got the ticket still, Otto?
Yes.
Good. I'm coming to the fight then. Afterwards, we wandered a long time through the city. The streets, though lit, were deserted. Electric signs glowed. Lights burned in the shop windows to no purpose. In one were naked wax dummies with painted heads. They looked ghostly and perverted. Next door was a sparkle of jewelry. Then a department store, floodlit, standing out white like a cathedral. Its show windows foaming with gay-colored silks. Pale, half-starved figures were crouched outside a picture house, and alongside, a ham and beef shop spread its splendors. Canned fruits piled high into tin towers, peaches bedded in wadding, fat geese strung on a line like so much washing, loaves of brown bread among highly seasoned ham sausages, and central in it all, gleaming pink and pale yellow, liver patties and sliced salmon. We sat down on a seat near the park. The night was cool, and the moon stood like an arc lamp over the roofs of the houses. It was already past midnight. Workmen repairing the tram lines had pitched a tent on the pavement hard by. The bellows hissed, and showers of sparks rained down upon the solemn, bowed figures. Alongside stood cauldrons of tar, smoking like field kitchens. We sank into a brown study. Queer sort of day, Sunday, Otto. Custer nodded. One is glad when it's over, said I meditatively. Custer shrugged his shoulders.
Perhaps it is that one is so used to the routine that one finds the little bit of freedom disturbing.
I turned up my coat collar.
Doesn't say much for the life we lead, Otto.
He looked at me and smiled.
There was less to be said for it a few years ago, Bob.
True, I agreed. Still. The acid light of the pneumatic drill squirted green over the asphalt. The workman's shelter with its inner glow looked like a cozy little country to itself.
Do you think the Cadillac will be ready by Tuesday?
I asked.
Perhaps, said Custer. Why?
I was just wondering.
We stood up and turned homeward. I've been a bit snarled up today, Otto, said I.
Everybody is, now and then, said Custer. Sleep well, Bob.
Good night, Otto.
In my room, I continued to sit a while. Suddenly, I did not like the place anymore. The chandelier, hideous, the lights so glaring, and the armchairs, threadbare, the linoleum utterly dreary, the washstand. You could never invite any decent person here, I thought. Not a woman, certainly. A prostitute from the International, at the most.